Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. This is the latest edition of Dresbert. I'm Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor of political science at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I write the Spoiler Alerts blog for the Washington Post, and I am the author of the revived edition of Theories of International Politics and Zombies, out in bookstores this month.
I'm Heather Hurlburt. I direct the New Models Policy Change program at New America.
And we are going to start off by talking about Ebola, I believe. So quite the events over the weekend.
Yep, it's interesting. This is one of those times that I feel like we could have a completely different quarantine regime in place by the time this airs, because as we're recording on Monday morning, we're watching the governors of New York and New Jersey engage in a slow, unedifying climb down.
Right, so... So on, I believe it was on Friday, they together decided we're going to impose this mandatory quarantine of all healthcare workers that come in from West Africa. At which point, they had the bad luck to run into an actual healthcare worker coming in from West Africa. So she got into Newark. They quarantined her. They did not use the best of procedures in quarantining her, and she is legitimately pissed off about this. Or as I would put it, I think I put it in my blog post this morning, she received better treatment in Sierra Leone than she received in the Newark airport.
I have to say, they also had the misfortune to run into an extremely photogenic and media-savvy healthcare professional, which I mean in the best possible way, actually, because people who sort of try to think about how do you dramatize an issue, so here's a woman. She's an American woman. She's in her early 30s. She's a nurse. She's from Texas. She comes off as very likable.
I thought she was from Maine. Sorry.
Oh, you're right. No, she's from Maine. She, her medical, her
oh,
medical.
Fair enough. Yeah,
her,
yeah.
So she was, this is the brilliant part of this is her op-ed was written, was published by a Dallas paper as hometown
yes.
girl. And so.
That's true.
And the piece, you know, she talks about what she was doing, how her last day before leaving Africa, she, you know, basically sat with a child and watched it die of Ebola. And then got on the plane to come to New Jersey where people freaked out and looked at her funny. You know, she's sent to a hospital. The hospital says, this is ridiculous. You don't have a fever. What are you doing here? You know, the people at the airport didn't understand the difference between sort of putting a little strip on your forehead to test your temperature versus actually testing your temperature.
Yeah, that was appalling. I got to say that. I mean, you know, anyone who's a parent knows that that is a lousy way to take a temperature, just, you know. I mean, that's the part that I actually do find ridiculous, but go ahead.
Well, you know, I mean, anybody who's ever come through that particular airport system didn't find that surprising. But
it's true, yes,
but,
fair enough.
You know, this whole, the Ebola issue set, and in some ways the counterterrorism issue set as well, the argument which is counterintuitive at a sort of primitive rat brain fear level that, instead of just battening down the hatches, you actually have to open up, go to the source of the problem, and solve it. You know, I have been pleasantly surprised by how much the administration was willing to get out and try to make that argument. It's a very hard argument to make in a fear-driven media environment, but this woman, you know, this woman is a gift from God. That she is making that case at a sort of understandable human level. And so Cuomo... policy result over the weekend, Cuomo starts to back off the quarantine, and this morning Christie has now announced this nurse will be released. It's not clear to me whether the state of New Jersey is going to try to continue to quarantine less media savvy health workers. The state of New York says you can stay home. You don't have to stay in a tent outside the hospital.
Right. So, I mean, a few things. First of all, I think you're right, and in some ways, this was the perfect storm to call into question what Cuomo and Christie had done. I mean, even though it was clear when they announced this on Friday, they had consulted no experts. I mean, all of the media reports I've seen suggest that, you know, the New York Health Department, you know, the CDC, NIH, you know, you name it, none of them had been consulted when they made this decision, and they were all justifiably furious. But that in and of itself might not, you know, might have led to something of a firestorm. It's the fact that this woman, you know, was actually not just, you know, that, you know, she put a face to what the implications are of this. You know, in some ways, the bias in all of this has always been abundance of caution. Well, what's the worst that could happen if you, you know, overreach in terms of quarantines? It turns out the worst thing that can happen is you actually, you know, restrict someone's civil liberties, and they complain about it. And so, it, you know, politically, this was in some ways disastrous for Cuomo and Christie. I don't want to defend them, but I will say the following. The eerie thing for me, as this has all played out this month, and I hate to say this, is the extent to which this has actually gone exactly as I wrote in the zombie book. I swear to God. So in the chapters I have written on domestic politics and bureaucratic politics, I said the following things would happen. That if you had an emergence of something like, you know, the Living Dead, you would have governments trying desperately to ensure that, you know, the situation is normal, there is no need to panic, and so on and so forth. And the initial response would be to say, okay, the government has got this. But at the same time, precisely because you are dealing with a non-standard situation, bureaucracies will screw up. There will be errors, there will be mistakes, and so on and so forth. Which I think we saw the CDC commit, you know, in terms of what happened in Dallas. And they've copped to the fact that their initial guidelines on this were based on a WHO protocol, which might be appropriate for rural West Africa, but very inappropriate for an urban advanced industrialized democracy. But the funny thing is that the tragedy is that as bureaucracies learn and they get better at coping with these things, at the same time, the public begins to reject their advice. So I think the CDC, for example, is much better equipped now to handle what's going on in terms of Ebola than they were a month ago. The problem is that the CDC has also taken a hit in terms of the public, and therefore some politicians feel free, you know, the governors of New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and Florida, to ignore what the CDC is saying. And I suppose the defense one could make of Christie and Cuomo is that, to be fair, their quarantine is going to, you know, they're moving down the learning curve as well. And they're realizing, oh, crap, we made mistakes and we've got to do this, you know, a better job as well. And so I suppose the hope is that they eventually converge to some sort of happy medium in terms of dealing with this. But I will simply close this peroration with observing that any time the state of Florida agrees with you on something, it's probably a bad policy decision.
Well, I will now go back to the politics of this, and I will say that I actually don't think that Chris Christie will suffer for this. And I think Christie read his national audience, which is to say 2016 GOP primary voters, correctly. And I very much doubt that he will suffer from this at all. Cuomo, on the other hand, if you assume that Cuomo's whole life right now is about positioning himself to pick up every single Hillary Clinton donor in the event that she decides not to run, I do think Cuomo actually hurt himself rather badly by sort of letting the momentary both. And I think the other thing that one has to acknowledge is it is a giant pain for epidemiologists, health investigators to have to go every place that that doctor went and, you know, check out every bowling alley in Brooklyn. But, you know, guess what? That is, in fact, what they get paid for. So, so, you know, but Cuomo, I think, made a major misstep in terms of his future viability as a Democratic primary candidate.
I don't know. Why do you – I mean, I agree with you on Cuomo. I think if anything – I think John Podhoretz, admittedly not an impartial observer, but I think was accurate in saying, you know, now – you know, this is Andrew Cuomo revealed in terms of the sort of pure political machinations. I'm surprised to hear you say, though, that you think Christie will not suffer among his base. Well, I mean, do you think it's because the base is just so freaked out about Ebola that they'll see this as an example of leadership? Because – and the reason I say this is that I've actually seen a fair amount – I would say the criticism of Christie in this has been actually pretty bipartisan, at least on Twitter, which I grant you is not representative. So go ahead.
Well, I'm now pondering if Twitter were primary voters, I'm trying to decide whether that would be a better place or an even worse place than what we currently have.
Fair enough.
But if I'm assuming that Christie, the primary audience he cares about right now is people who will vote in the 2016 Republican primary. Mm-hmm. And most of those people already suspect that he's a secret squishy liberal because he's from New Jersey and liberals like him. Mm-hmm. So, and also those folks are getting bathed in a daily diet of media on Ebola, which say, never mind quarantine. They just think we shouldn't let people into the country from West Africa. So to those folks, Christie didn't do anything that seems even slightly out of line.
See, this is where – I mean, I wrote about this morning. I think one of the oddities about the way people are handling Ebola or the way the political response to Ebola is that in some ways it goes against both sides' natural ideological predilections, which is in some ways what Republicans are advocating is what we would call a precautionary principle approach to handling Ebola, which is to say we don't know enough you know, about what's going on. Ergo, we should regulate and tamp down on anything that has even the slightest chance of something bad happening. And you know who normally advocates this sort of thing? European liberals.
Right. So just to draw out your parallel there, for example, yeah. if you applied to genetically modified organisms the approach right. that Republicans are applying to Ebola, we wouldn't be consuming any of them because we'd still be testing them. If right. you applied to new chemicals or nanotechnology the approach that Republicans are applying to Ebola, we wouldn't have any of those products yet.
Exactly. And so I think, and to be fair, I would actually argue smarter conservatives, I've actually been pretty impressed with, like, you know, some of the stuff, like, let's say National Review Online is, or National Review is written on this, you know, like Yuval Levin or Jonah Goldberg. I actually think they've supported a travel ban, but they're also acknowledging this is actually a debate as opposed to just sort of an obvious thing to do. And I think part of the deeper reason for that kind of wariness is precisely what happens if you generalize from the response to Ebola to the, you know, the sort of wider regulatory arena. And I think this is why I'm not entirely sure Christie is going to come off smelling like a rose on this, because 2 years from now, when everyone has forgotten about the actual Ebola panic and everyone has sort of pointed out, you know what, Christie overreached again. He, you know, he used the state to restrict someone's liberties. That's not necessarily going to play terribly well, especially with 2016 primary voters in the GOP.
Well, this is where sort of starting to shift into full-throatedly into the political conversation. We have the GOP in particular is really sort of running a bunch of experiments with the politics of fear right now, both on Syria, ISIS, terrorism, and on Ebola. But right. what's fascinating is that you have two currents that push towards opposite policy solutions. Because if you fearmonger on ISIS in Syria, then what you want to do is more bombing, maybe right. ground troops. And it's very much, to go back to your argument, the sort of let's go deal with it over there before we have to deal with it over here. Let's go right. wipe out the terrorists. So, but then,
I mean, in some ways, Dick Cheney's 1% doctrine, actually, this is Dick Cheney's 1% doctrine, implemented.
Yeah.
Sorry,
and
go ahead.
So for people who have better things to do than follow, god awful ad campaigns in midterm years, the NRCC actually cut an ad using footage of, James Foley just before he was executed, which.
Oh god, really?
Yeah, which to my mind sort of marks a new, you can find it on YouTube still.
Yeah.
Marks a new low. I mean, I didn't think such a thing was possible, but. And the voiceover says, terrorism is rising. Are we safe? Who will protect us? So it doesn't get much more blatant than that. And they've cut a couple of other terrorism ads, and what's fascinating is they are almost entirely running in campaigns where the Democratic opponent is a woman.
Oh, that's good. That's interesting.
So there is this very specific targeting that's happening.
So it's Louisiana, North Carolina, where else?
New Hampshire. Scott Brown criticized Jean Shaheen and said we should close the border. We should close the Mexican border because, of course, the Mexicans would be justified in closing the border because, you know, we have Ebola cases and they don't. But it didn't seem to have occurred to him. It was interestingly a woman veteran Republican running against Kristen Sinema in Arizona also used it until it was criticized and Foley's parents said, you know, please don't do this. And it was taken down. But, you know, so you have those ads which are saying do more, do more, do more. And then you have the Republican response to Ebola or the one wing of the Republican Party response to Ebola, which is close the borders, do less, you know, never mind helping out West Africa. So I keep thinking about at what point does the incoherence of the fear-based arguments sort of finally bump up against itself?
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate here and argue that, in fact, I don't think these messages are necessarily as mutually contradictory as you think, because there is a larger theme that you can use here, which is what I actually think the GOP is doing. I think there are two themes they're trying to press with all of these, because if you actually take a look at the polling, there's not a ton of evidence that these issues individually, you know, ISIS, Ebola, Russia and Ukraine, what have you, you know, are really, you know, top level concerns of the voters. It's still, of course, the economy. But there are two ways in which you can use all of them together to feed two themes that you would want primary voters to believe. The first is this view that the Obama administration – the first is this view that the world is spinning out of control. So the idea is that there is chaos spreading elsewhere. Now there might be different ways of dealing with that chaos if you're talking about terrorism or as opposed to Ebola, but the point is that, you know, if you amp up the fear factor, then obviously that indicts the Obama administration's foreign policy record in terms of handling this. So that's one thing you can do. The second, and in some ways far deeper criticism, and I think this one is the one that actually will resonate better, is the notion that precisely because we're operating in a more uncertain world, because there are, you know, sort of myriad threats out there as opposed to one single overarching threat, you need competent government. And weirdly enough, this is where I think the Republicans can actually criticize, and this is I think the most damning indictment you can make politically of Barack Obama's administration, is that he has actually given off the impression that the government does not know what it's doing. Which is, in theory, Democrats are supposed to care about this. There's, you know, they're all about competence. They're all about, you know, making sure the government does a good job. But you can argue that, you know, the sort of national security establishment was asleep at the switch when it came to ISIS spinning out of control. You can argue that the CDC has screwed up in terms of handling Ebola. You know, this is not to mention the other myriad sort of, you know, partisan scandals that the Republicans like to preach, like Benghazi or the IRS or what have you. And this doesn't even get to the NSA and Ed Snowden and so on and so forth. If you combine all of these, you have a theme which is not that the Obama administration is corrupt. That's often the sort of de facto one, but rather that, in fact, the administration is incompetent. And ergo, you need a strong Congress to apply, you know, strong oversight to make sure that this government is actually doing what it's supposed to be doing.
So you couldn't see how near I came to plunging my head into the keyboard as you laid out that argument. And in fact, I mean, I actually think the good news for progressives is that I have not seen Republican candidates making a competence argument, I think, because, sort of their base voters who are most likely to come out and vote in an off year
don't care.
I think that's a great 2016 argument you just laid out, and I hope that, Governor Perry's folks don't see this video that we're going to put up on the internet.
The one video we don't want Governor Perry to see.
No, I do think the competence are, I mean, competence is a challenging thing to get to play in politics. So, people have been debating recently whether and how 2014 or 2016 candidates could make a competence argument. Something right. I wanted to add that so Walmart, oddly, has decided that it really likes the idea of Walmart moms as a supposed voting demographic. And this is really hilarious. You know, every election cycle for the past at least 12 and maybe more like 20 years, we've had, you know, we had security moms, we had soccer moms, we had, I don't even remember, but, and every 4 years we sort of get told that, the election.
This is the key demographic.
Yes, the election is going to be decided by basically lower middle class women.
My call for 2016, it'll be urban hipster moms.
No, it's Walmart. See, this is the thing, that Walmart seems to have decided that it not only wants to embrace this, it wants to brand it. So Walmart is retaining a Democratic and Republican pollster to do focus groups with women who fit in this once a month, which just sort of the privatization of the culture of talking about politics is kind of amazing. Only in America you can commodify everything. But anyway, I have to say, I am grateful to Walmart because these focus groups are fascinating. And one of the things that
So the information is available publicly?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, good.
Or some of it is. You know, you always, you assume.
Right, obviously.
The part where they ask them, the part where they ask them whether they would be willing to pay $6 as opposed to $5 for a t-shirt or that part they don't release.
The stuff we care about, though.
Right.
So go ahead.
Right. Was that the comment that they made in September, the women were quite concerned about ISIS and the possibility of attacks here. And in October, they felt like that anxiety had migrated almost entirely from ISIS to Ebola. So there was just this free-floating anxiety.
Fear, yeah.
Fear, and that if there were national security issues that it could be attached to, it would be attached to them. And I think that's something that policy wonks often miss in this conversation. And you know, unlike 12 years ago, where the anxiety was very specific, that we're now living in this age of just kind of generalized anxiety, which I think proceeds as much from the weird economic situation as from the actual realities of the international situation. But, and I think progressives have been slow to comprehend this, and maybe Republicans have picked up on it a little faster, everybody is a little anxious. And that's going to change politics, and that's going to change the contours within which you can maneuver on national security issues.
That's possible, but I think what it leads to is the very strategy that I was talking about, which is that precisely because it's difficult to talk about any one individual sort of threat as being paramount in the same way that it was, you know, back in 2002, what you wind up doing is just sort of throwing everything against the wall and hoping two things happen. Either one specific issue sticks, or more generally, the idea that if you throw enough threats out there, people get the idea, even if they don't focus on one particular threat, they get the overarching theme. And again, I suspect that that actually is a strategy that it would not surprise me if the GOP tries to seize in the last week or so of this campaign.
Yeah. Well, the thing I see is the GOP using fear to mobilize its base. And in fact, I mean, so the GOP has used fear on international security issues to mobilize its base, and Democrats have used fear on, hey, Republicans are going to go out and vote, and you guys need to go out and vote too. So they've actually been using fear on domestic issues to try to mobilize their base, you know, lest we become totally partisan here. So, you know, what's interesting is I think, and for me, very discouraging, having spent, you know, the last 15 years really working on this set of issues, is that in some ways, Democrats are back to where they were in 2004 in terms of trying to think about how to counter fear-based attacks.
Right. Are you going to bring up the Kerry interview with the New York Times Magazine?
No, but you can.
Well, no. So this is what I always think of when you bring up this, which is that, you know, Kerry on national security at one point in an interview, I don't know if it was with Matt Bye, I can't remember who it was with, talked about the idea of how should the United States deal with terrorism. And he basically said, we should deal with terrorism the same way we deal with other crimes, which is to say, you know, we think about it as in a criminal matter. We acknowledge that this thing will occasionally happen, but we don't change our way of life for it. But of course, everyone reacted to it by saying, you know, Kerry says terrorism will happen again. And he got pilloried pretty badly for it.
Even though, guess what? He was quite right.
In some ways, he was right, yes.
Yeah. No, and the thing, you know, that has really happened over the last 6 or 7 years is that the White House, you know, through the first term, did really well on national security public opinion, and even for a while into the second term.
Yeah.
And there was a certain amount of coasting on that, and frankly, Democrats in Congress did not really, number one, they didn't reap any benefit from it in their own standing in public opinion for reasons which are sort of obvious. And there wasn't really sort of learning and growth. And so now, you know, I think the Democratic nominee in 2016 will have a certain amount of ability to use the you don't want to change horses while the world is this crazy. And you don't want to, particularly, I think if it's Clinton, will be able to say, look, you know, I've had decades of experience. And, you know, none of the people that look like they might be the Republican nominee right now has any significant international experience. So if it's Clinton, she's, or Biden, they would be able to play the sort of experienced statesman, don't change horses in midstream argument. But other than that, you're really, it's quite fascinating how, the president who killed Osama bin Laden, nonetheless, sort of, we're back in the mommy party versus daddy party scenario.
Well, actually, you bring up another reason, which we haven't talked about, but what it's one of the reasons why this theme has emerged, which is, I think, it's, as you say, the administration did a decent job, you can argue, in the first term. The problem is that now all the first term memoirs have come out. and the extent to which, in some ways, that sort of from the summer, the biggest criticisms levied against the Obama national security team has not necessarily come from Republicans. It's come from, well, I mean, Bob Gates, I guess so, but it's come from his own former team, Bob Gates, Leon Panetta, to much lesser extent, Hillary Clinton. You know, they all bring up, and unfortunately, in some ways, it was a perfect timing because Syria broke as a major issue right around the time that these memoirs started coming out. And that was the issue on which Obama had the greatest disagreement with his, you know, with his former policy principles. And I think the other thing this brings up, and you know, you're probably aware of the inner nuances of this better than I am, but I'm thinking of that Michael Hirsch piece in Politico that just came out last night or this morning, pointing out, you know, the fact that you've got a lot of grumbling within Obama's national security team about the way that he's running foreign policy, in no small part because it is so centralized within the White House that I think a lot of other agencies feel like they don't necessarily, you know, have a significant amount of input in terms of decision making.
I love it. It doesn't happen very often, but this is one of those moments where if you had to guess which one of us lived inside Beltway and which one of us lived outside Beltway, because come on, nobody cares about those memoirs other than sort of the community they were written for. And so I actually think that the Republican hammering at Obama on national security and becoming bolder and bolder and bolder about what it's okay to criticize a sitting president for, that has had much more effect across the country than the Gates and Panetta memoirs.
I'd push back a little bit. Let me put it this way. I think what the memoirs do is that they add multiple news cycles that allow reporters to talk about this theme more generally.
Well, and they embolden, what I will give you is that they make reporters and editor and assignment editors feel like it's a legitimate topic. So
right, exactly.
Then you book, you know, Gates puts out a memoir, and then you book a bunch of Republicans to talk about Gates' memoir, and you sort of, and Democrats, and it goes from there. But
also, the Panetta one in particular is problematic because, you know, Gates was a George W. Bush appointee. Hillary Clinton actually, I think, pulled her punches significantly in her memoir, so that wasn't as big of a deal. Panetta, on the other hand, A, did not pull his punches, and B, is a Democrat. And so, you know, it allows people when they go on talk shows or when they're going campaigning, saying, even Leon Panetta, you know, has, you know, taken the president to the carpet for ill-considered decision-making or, you know, inaction in Syria.
Okay, but I'll say again, if you didn't have a concerted day-in, day-out drumbeat from people who are speaking in local media on a daily basis, nobody would care about Leon Panetta. And I don't...
I think it would be... It's more accurate to say no one would care about Leon Panetta if Syria doesn't look like it's going badly and if Iraq doesn't look like it's going badly and there are these other concerns. So, but I will grant you that local media plays obviously a large role here also.
Yeah, and it's not even, it's sort of national political concerns. And I think there's an interesting case to be made that Gates, being an actual Republican, you know, being, working with, closely with Stephen Hadley, you know, Gates had a longer term agenda in mind, maybe. Panetta, I don't think had a longer term agenda in mind. I think Panetta had a very immediate agenda in mind. And, you know, I think.
Meaning to sell books, or you mean when he was, what are we talking about?
Both to sell books and, I mean, as I think he said, you know, he was asked somewhere, hey, why did you do this now? People don't usually do this now. And he said, well, you know, I really wanted the president to hear some things I couldn't get him to hear when I was in office. Now, you know, me, I don't know that I don't know. On the one hand, I don't think that this was necessarily a very effective method. On the other hand, I have no idea what it would be like to be a cabinet secretary and feel like that wasn't a very effective method. So
I was going to say. Yeah.
No, but I think Panetta was thinking, I mean, Panetta was really thinking inside this political cycle in his aims for impact and where Gates
right.
was. Although.
There's a longer term agenda.
Yeah, although I also just have to say that the whole culture around political memoirs, it's not totally clear to me that the process encourages the taking of strategic long-term agendas?
Yes. Well, also, I mean, you know, let's face it, the culture here has shifted somewhat. I think my favorite moment in all of this, someone highlighted it, because I confess I have read none of these memoirs, but that apparently Gates in his memoir recounts a meeting in which Obama, you know, instructs his cabinet, all right, take notes clearly here, because you're going to want to take the notes accurately for your own memoirs. And Gates writes, you know, I found this a distasteful joke. In his memoirs, he wrote that. So, you know, it does suggest the ways in which this culture has changed.
Well, I'm quite old school about this. I wrote an article, not a memoir, and I was not a senior, I was not a cabinet official, to put it mildly. I was not a confirmed official. I wrote an article in 2002 about Democrats and national security policy, which included,
oh, I remember that article.
Which included an account of a discussion inside the White House and a speech that was never given. And Sandy Berger was furious with me and wouldn't, you know, was angry and let it be known with me that he was angry for a number of months because I had written about internal deliberations of a White House. And that, you know, I felt like he was overreacting at the time, but it feels really quaint and nice to me compared to this kind of, you know, take your notes in a meeting for your memoir. And, you know, the idea that, you know, when you're in that room, I mean, if everybody in that room is not trying to do their best for the country and not sort of worrying about what you're going to look like in the person next to you's memoirs, that is a real problem. So, I'm kind of old school on that one. Of course, it's easier. Easier to be old school not having served in the Obama administration and not having a book to sell, right? I mean,
Although it's now, I guess, I mean, in some ways, the Panetta book, you know, would never have had a better market than now. So. Yeah. That's a fair point. All right. Well, you know what? We need to leave the sordid, squalid nature of Beltway memoirs and go north of the border. So Heather, I think you had some thoughts on the sort of, the terrorist attacks that took place in Ottawa, and the Canadian reaction to them.
Well, I've been watching with fascination the American reaction to the Canadian reaction. Because I had the good fortune to go on MSNBC the evening the attacks happened and have the rather surreal experience of being questioned by the host about, didn't I think that Canada wasn't giving out enough information? And didn't,
who is this?
Ed Schultz.
Okay.
And didn't I think that Canada, you know, just, and basically saying, well, no, because they don't work the way we work. And also, I think you being a Bostonian, I'm curious your thoughts on this, that, you know, that the way the government of Ottawa, sort of what they did and didn't shut down, I thought was in some ways a reaction to the way that Boston was so shut down during the manhunts after the marathon bombing and the perception that maybe that had been overdone and people had been terrorized in areas where there was not the necessity of terrorizing them. So it seems to me, you know, definitely Canada has a different culture about this, but also that there had been some learning around, you know, no, shutting down an entire city does not produce the results you want.
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about what happened in Boston. I mean, I would say in some ways the thing that I was proudest of in terms of the way Ottawa handled it is that they opened up the parliament the next day. I thought that was a great way of sort of demonstrating the resilience. And in some way, let me put it this way. I think that there's been a lot of learning going on. The thing that struck me, I was watching the Fareed Zakaria show, and I was struck that Michael Hayden, who is not known for saying this kind of rhetoric, I don't think, was stressing the idea that what we should learn from the Ottawa attack is the notion that what we need to have is resiliency rather than pure prevention. And I was a little taken aback that it was Michael Hayden making this, because I'm pretty sure that was not the arguments that he was making when he was in government. But he's also absolutely right that in some ways, and this goes back to the Kerry argument from 2004, that what you want to demonstrate is that if an attack takes place, you know, it actually doesn't succeed in promoting terror. That, you know, you sort of keep calm and carry on. In terms of the contrast to the Boston incident, the problem is that the Boston situation was unique in two ways. The first was they actually ID'd suspects and they were alive as opposed to being trapped somewhere or what have you. And second, and this is always what people forget about that incident, is that it was during a week when schools were closed. And so I think weirdly enough, they got away with the lockdown of the city and my suburb, because people were home already with kids. And so it wasn't as much of an inconvenience, as people realized, or as people maybe elsewhere might have thought. I think in retrospect, they probably did obviously overreact. I think it also helped that in the end, they actually managed to capture the guy. So, it was a somewhat successful outcome, but, you're right that it does represent a sort of contrasting aspect in terms of national culture. And I think there's a way in which you could argue maybe we could learn a little bit from Canada.
Well, another contrast that I would draw, which is a very unhappy one. So here is a guy who has a history of mental instability, who's identified by the authorities both for having a history of mental instability and for having sort of connected with a group that is known to encourage violent behavior. He has a gun. He kills one person before he's killed. Last Friday, you have an individual with a gun go to a school and kill, so far, two people. And, you know, who knows how those other kids in hospital are going to do. And we are, We are disgustingly resilient about school shootings. Disgustingly resilient. No one ever thinks, I mean, with Newtown, the exception, where all of us hugged our kids a little extra, but, you know, I didn't think anything extra about my kid going to school this Monday morning. We are nauseatingly resilient as a nation about school shootings. And, there's a lot of reasons that that's not a good comparison, but what is a good comparison about it is we have school shootings, we have them, you know, every couple months, and there's nothing on the horizon that suggests we're going to stop having them anytime soon. Something else I get asked all the time is, are lone wolves the future of terrorism? And the answer is no, lone wolves are the present of terrorism. Yeah. And, you know, frankly, they kill a lot fewer people than school shootings do. And so you got to ask yourself, you know, we clearly have immense capacity for resilience, but maybe we don't have the capacity to target it in the right places.
That is an extremely depressing note to close on, but I have to say I don't have an answer to this. I tend to think that no, I got nothing on this. It's depressing. I mean, maybe the only way, thing I would say is that you're talking about it in terms of resilience. Unfortunately, I would say in some ways it's just that we're a nerd to it at this point.
Well, I'll say something that's maybe a little more optimistic. And a Canadian friend wrote a very nice piece in the New Yorker, which I had the honor of being quoted in, talking about the connections between among mental illness, extremism, and yep, lone wolf acts of violence. And, you know, one of the things, so given that we haven't done anything, we aren't willing to do anything as a society about choking off access to guns, and that's not a perfect answer, as you see in the Canadian case.
Right.
There has been a lot of interest, you know, since Columbine among mental health professionals about how do you identify and care for and prevent acts of violence among young people. And if you look at the profiles of the young men who have done lone wolf acts of violence from what they said were radical Islamist motives, there are a lot of similarities. And there's interesting work being done on sort of strengthening local communities, strengthening schools, strengthening mosques, strengthening local police and community centers to give people, you know, so that, I mean, the guy, the Canadian who ran over a couple soldiers with his car and killed one, his
right,
father had reported him to the cops. You know, how awful is that, that the guy's father saw that he had lost control of his kid and tried to get help. So that's an area where we actually know things from mental health about how to identify and try to deal with people in those situations. And if we can't get control of guns, which I think we can anytime soon, and if we can't magically make ISIS and its fellows go away, which we can't, that is an area, you know, understanding that this is about radical recruitment, but it's also about sick and flawed individuals, and that's something where we as a society do have some tools to work on. So that's my effort to be slightly less depressing.
That was very constructive, actually. I feel better now. I think we...
I want a gif of you saying, I feel better now.
Exactly. Well, I think we should close. On that note, I do want to thank you, Heather. You came up to Fletcher earlier this month for a conference that I ran on the role of think tanks in the marketplace of foreign policy ideas, and you did an absolutely spectacular job. I would encourage everyone who likes Dresburg will enjoy all of the panels are now available online at the Fletcher YouTube channel. There were some very lively exchanges, of which Heather was part of them. So thanks again for coming for that.
No, you're welcome. And for anyone who is interested in debates around objectivity, around the influence of money on ideas, there was some really interesting stuff to be mined there, and I think that sort of different levels of, you know, just quickly, that other institutions in the U.S. are now somewhat used to having their credibility attacked all the time, and this is a community that's really just at the beginning of its surprise that people think it might not be perfect, and
right,
and you know, it's having sort of maybe because my parents are journalists and I've sort of watched the decline of journalism as this happened over my lifetime, but it's just fascinating to see this in its infancy. So I really recommend a couple of Dan's panels, which are highly informative in this regard.
Well, thanks a lot, and have a happy Halloween.
And a happy Halloween to you. Until next month.
Yep.
Don't let the zombies bite.